burrow grubs. They caught her at the intersection of two identical corridors, both lined with pillars and torches, and scarlet pennants bearing the twisting gold flame that was Galbatorix's insignia. Nasawada had not expected to escape, not really, but she could not help but feel disappointed at her failure. If nothing else, she had hoped to cover more distance before they recaptured her. She fought the whole way as the soldiers dragged her back to the chamber that had been her prison. The men wore chest plates and vambraces, but she still managed to scratch their faces and bite their hands, wounding a pair of the men rather severely. The soldiers uttered exclamations of dismay when they entered the hall of the soothsayer and saw what she had done to her jailer. Careful not to step in the pooling blood, they carried her to the slab of stone, strapped her down, then hurried away, leaving her alone with the corpse. She shouted at the ceiling and yanked at her restraints, angry with herself for not having done better. Still simmering, she glanced at the body on the floor, then quickly looked away. In death, the man's expression seemed accusatory, and she could not bear to gaze upon it. After she stole the spoon, she had spent hours grinding the end of the handle against the stone slab. The spoon had been made of soft iron, so it was easy to shape. She had thought that Galbatorix and Murtagh would visit her next, but instead it was her jailer, bringing her what might have been a late dinner. He had started to undo her manacles in preparation for escorting her to the privy room. The moment he freed her left hand, she stabbed him underneath the chin with the sharpened handle of the spoon, burying the utensil in the folds of his wattle. The man squealed a horrible, high-pitched sound that reminded her of a pig at slaughter, and spun thrice around, flailing his arms, then fell to the floor, where he lay thrashing and frothing and drumming his heels for what seemed an unreasonably long time. Killing him had troubled her. She did not think the man had been evil. She was not sure what he had been. But there had been a simpleness to him that made her feel as if she had taken advantage. Still, she had done what was necessary, and though she now found it unpleasant to consider, she remained convinced that her actions had been justified. As the man lay convulsing in his death throes, she had unfastened the rest of the restraints and jumped off the slab. Then, steeling her nerve, she pulled the spoon out of the man's neck, which, like a stopper removed from the bung of a barrel, released a spray of blood that splattered her legs and caused her to jump backward while stifling a curse. The two guards outside the hall of the soothsayer had been easy enough to deal with. She had caught them by surprise and killed the right-hand guard in much the same way she had killed her jailer. Then she had drawn the dagger from the guard's belt and attacked the other man, even as he struggled to bring his pike to bear upon her. Up close, a pike was no match for a dagger, and she had unseamed him before he had a chance to escape or raise the alarm. She had not gotten very far after that, whether because of Galbatorix's spells or just plain bad luck. She ran headlong into a group of five soldiers, and they had quickly, if not easily, subdued her. It could not have been more than half an hour later when she heard a large group of men in iron-shod boots march up to the door of the chamber, and then Galbatorix stormed in, followed by several guards. As always, he stopped at the edge of her line of sight, and there he stood, a tall, dark figure with an angular face, only the outlines of which were visible. She saw his head turn as he took in the scene. Then in a cold voice he said, "How did this happen?" A soldier with a plume on his helm scurried in front of Galbatorix, knelt, and held out her sharpened spoon.
"Sire, we found this in one of the men outside."
The king took the spoon and turned it over in his hands.
"I see."
His head swiveled toward her. He gripped the ends of the spoon and, without discernible effort, bent it until it snapped in two.
"You knew you could not escape, and yet you insisted upon trying. I'll not have you killing my men merely to spite me. You have not the right to take their lives. You have not the right to do anything unless I allow it."
He flung the pieces of metal upon the floor. Then he turned and stalked out of the hall of the soothsayer, his heavy cape flapping behind him. Two of the soldiers removed her jailer's body, then scoured the chamber of his blood, cursing her as they scrubbed. Once they had left, and she was again alone, she allowed herself a sigh, and some of the tension in her limbs vanished. She wished she had had a chance to eat, for now that the excitement was over, she found she was hungry. Worse, she suspected she would have to wait hours before she could hope to have her next meal, assuming that Galbatorix did not decide to punish her by withholding food. Her musings about bread and roasts and tall glasses of wine were short-lived, as she again heard the sound of many boots in the passageway outside her cell. Startled, she tried to mentally prepare herself for whatever unpleasantness was about to come, for it would be unpleasant, she was sure. The door to the chamber crashed open, and two sets of footsteps echoed in the octagonal room as Murtagh and Galbatorix walked over to her. Murtagh positioned himself where he usually did, but without the brazier to occupy himself, he crossed his arms, leaned against the wall, and glared at the floor. What she could see of his expression beneath his silver half-mask did not comfort her. The lines of his face seemed even harder than normal, and there was something about the cast of his mouth that sent a chill of fear into her bones. Instead of sitting, as was his wont, Galbatorix stood behind and somewhat to the side of her head, where she could feel his presence more than she could see it. He extended his long, claw-like hands over her. In them he held a small box, decorated with lines of carved horn that might have formed glyphs from the ancient language. Most disconcerting of all, a faint "scree, scree" sound came from within the container, soft as the scratching of a mouse, but no less distinct. With the pad of his thumb, Galbatorix pushed open the box's sliding lid. Then he reached inside and pulled out what appeared to be a large, ivory-coloured maggot. The creature was almost 3 inches long, and it had a tiny mouth at one end, with which it uttered the "scree, scree" she had heard before, announcing its displeasure to the world. It was plump and pleated, like a caterpillar, but if it had any legs, they were so small as to be invisible. As the creature wiggled in a vain attempt to free itself from between Galbatorix's fingers, the king said, "This is a burrow grub. It is not what it appears to be. Few things are, but in the case of burrow grubs, that is all the more true. They are found in only one place in Alagasia, and are far more difficult to capture than you might suppose. Take it, then, as a sign of my regard for you, Nasawada, daughter of Arjahad, that I deign to use one on you." His voice dropped in tone, becoming even more intimate. "I would not, however, wish to exchange places with you." The "scree, scree" of the burrow grub increased in volume as Galbatorix dropped it onto the bare skin of her right arm, just below the elbow. She flinched as the disgusting creature landed on her. It was heavier than it looked, and its underside gripped her with what felt like hundreds of little hooks. The burrow grub squalled for a moment more, then it gathered up its body in a tight bundle and hopped several inches up her arm. She wrenched at her bonds, hoping to dislodge the grub, but it continued to cling to her. Again it hopped, and again, and now it was on her shoulder, the hooks pinching and digging into her skin like a strip of minute cockle burrs. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the burrow grub lift up its eyeless head and point it toward her face, as if testing the air. Its tiny mouth opened, and she saw that it had sharp, cutting mandibles behind its upper and lower lips.
"Scree, scree,"
said the burrow grub.
"Scree, scra."
"Not there," Galbatorix said,
and he spoke a word in the ancient language. On hearing it, the burrow grub swung away from her head, for which she felt a measure of relief. Then it began to worm its way back down her arm. Few things frightened her. The touch of the hot iron frightened her. The thought that Galbatorix might reign forevermore in Urubane frightened her. Death, of course, frightened her, although not so much because she feared the end of her existence, as because she feared leaving undone all the things she still hoped to accomplish. But for whatever reason, the sight and feel of the burrow grub unnerved her in a way that until that very moment nothing else had. Every muscle in her body seemed to burn and tingle, and she felt an overwhelming urge to run, to flee, to put as much distance between herself and the creature as she could. For there seemed to be something profoundly wrong about the burrow grub. It did not move as it should, and its obscene little mouth reminded her of a child's. And the sound it made, the horrible, horrible sound, elicited a primal loathing within her. The burrow grub paused by her elbow. Then its fat, limbless body contracted, and it hopped 4-5 inches straight up into the air, and then dove headfirst toward the inner part of her elbow. As it landed, the burrow grub divided into a dozen small, bright green centipedes, which swarmed over her arm before each chose a spot to sink its mandibles into her flesh and bore its way through her skin. The pain was too great for her to bear. She struggled against her restraints and screamed at the ceiling. But she could not escape her torment, not then, and not for a seemingly endless span of time thereafter. The iron had hurt more, but she would have preferred its touch, for the hot metal was impersonal, inanimate, and predictable. All things the burrow grub was not. There was a special horror in knowing that the cause of her pain was a creature chewing on her, and worse, that it was inside her. At the last, she lost her pride and self-control and cried out to the goddess Gokukara for mercy. And then she began to babble as a child might, unable to stop the flow of random words coming from her mouth. And behind her, she heard Galbatorix laughing, and his enjoyment of her suffering made her hate him all the more. She blinked, slowly coming back to herself. After several moments, she realized that Murtagh and Galbatorix were gone. She had no recollection of their departure. She must have lost consciousness. The pain was less than before, but she still hurt terribly. She glanced down her body, then averted her eyes, feeling her pulse quicken. Where the centipedes had been, she was not sure whether individually they were still considered burrow grubs. Her flesh was swollen, and lines of purple blood filled the tracks they had left underneath the surface of her skin, and every track burned. It felt as if she had been lashed across the front of her body with a metal whip. She wondered if perhaps the burrow grubs were still inside of her, lying dormant while they digested their meal. Or perhaps they were metamorphosing, like maggots into flies, and they would turn into something even worse. Or, and this seemed the most terrible possibility, perhaps they were laying eggs within her, and more of them would soon hatch and begin to feast on her. She shuddered and cried out with fear and frustration. The wounds made it difficult for her to remain coherent. Her vision faded in and out, and she found herself weeping, which disgusted her, but she could not stop, no matter how hard she tried. As a distraction, she fell to talking to herself, nonsense mostly, anything to bolster her resolve or focus her mind on other subjects. It helped, if only a little. She knew that Galbatorix did not want to kill her, but she feared that in his anger he had gone further than he intended. She was shaking,
and her entire body felt inflamed as if she had been stung by hundreds of bees. Willpower could sustain her for only so long. No matter how determined she was, there was a limit to what her frame could withstand. And she felt that she was well past that point. Something deep inside her seemed to have broken, and she was no longer confident that she could recover from her injuries. The door to the chamber scraped open. She forced her eyes to focus as she strained to see who was approaching. It was Murtagh. He looked down at her, his lips pinched, his nostrils flared, and a furrow between his brows. At first she thought he was angry, but then she realized he was actually worried and afraid, deathly so. The strength of his concern surprised her. She knew he regarded her with a certain liking. Why else would he have convinced Galbatorix to keep her alive? But she had not suspected that he cared for her quite so much. She tried to reassure him with a smile. It must not have come out right, for as she did, Murtagh clenched his jaw as if he was struggling to contain himself. "Try not to move," he said, and lifted his hands over her and began to murmur in the ancient language. "As if I could," she thought. His magic soon took effect, and wound by wound her pain abated, but it did not disappear entirely. She frowned at him, puzzled, and he said, "I'm sorry, I can do no more. Galbatorix would know how, but it's beyond me."
What about your Eldunari?" she asked. "Surely they can help."
He shook his head. "Young dragons all, or they were when their bodies died. They knew little of magic then, and Galbatorix has taught them almost nothing since. I'm sorry."
"Are those things still in me?"
"No, no, they're not. Galbatorix removed them once you passed out." Her relief was profound.
"Your spell didn't stop the pain."
She tried not to sound accusatory, but she could not prevent a note of anger from creeping into her voice. He grimaced.
"I'm not sure why. It ought to have. Whatever that creature is, it doesn't fit into the normal pattern of the world." "Do you know where it's from?"
"No. I only learned of it today, when Galbatorix fetched it from his inner chambers." She closed her eyes for a moment.
"Let me up.
Are you
Let me up."
Without a word, he undid her restraints. Then she got to her feet and stood swaying next to the slab, while she waited for an attack of lightheadedness to recede. "Here," said Murtagh, handing her his cape. She wrapped it around her body, covering herself for both modesty and warmth, and also so that she did not have to look at the burns, scabs, blisters, and blood-filled lines that disfigured her. Limping, for among other places, the burrow grub had visited the soles of her feet, she walked to the edge of the chamber. She leaned against the wall and slowly lowered herself to the floor. Murtagh joined her, and the two of them sat staring at the opposite wall. Despite herself, she began to cry. After a while, she felt him touch her shoulder, and she jerked away. She could not help it. He had hurt her more in the past few days than anyone else ever had, and though she knew he had not wanted to do it, she could not forget that it was he who had wielded the hot iron. Even so, when she saw how her reaction stung him, she relented and reached out and took his hand. He gave her fingers a gentle squeeze, then put his arm around her shoulders and drew her close. She resisted for a moment, then relaxed into his embrace and laid her head on his chest as she continued to cry, her quiet sobs echoing in the bare stone room. Some minutes later, she felt him move beneath her as he said,
"I'll find a way to free you, I swear. It's too late for Thorne and me, but not for you. As long as you don't pledge fealty to Galbatorix, there's still a chance I can spirit you out of Urubain."
She looked up at him and decided he meant what he said.
How?
She whispered.
I haven't the slightest idea,
he admitted with a roguish smile.
But I will, whatever it takes. You have to promise me, though, that you won't give up. Not until I've tried.
Agreed.
I don't think I can endure that thing again. If he puts it on me again, I'll give him whatever he wants.
You won't have to. He doesn't intend to use the Borogrubs again.
What does he intend?
Murtagh was silent for a minute more.
He's decided to start manipulating what you see, hear, feel, and taste. If that doesn't work, then he'll attack your mind directly.
You won't be able to resist him if he does. No one ever has.
Before it comes to that, though, I'm sure I'll be able to rescue you. All you have to do is keep fighting for another few days. That's it. Just another few days. How can I, if I can't trust my senses?
There is one sense he cannot feign. Murtagh twisted to look at her more directly.
Will you let me touch your mind? I won't try to read your thoughts. I only want you to know what my mind feels like, so you can recognize it, so you can recognize me in the future.
She hesitated. She knew that this was a turning point. Either she would agree to trust him, or she would refuse, and perhaps lose her only chance to avoid becoming Galbatorix's slave. Still, she remained wary of granting anyone access to her mind. Murtagh could be trying to lull her into lowering her defences so that he could more easily install himself in her consciousness. Or it might be that he hoped to glean some piece of information by eavesdropping on her thoughts. Then she thought, why should Galbatorix resort to such tricks? He could do either of those things himself. Murtagh is right. I wouldn't be able to resist him. If I accept Murtagh's offer, it may mean my doom. But if I refuse, my doom is inevitable. One way or another, Galbatorix will break me. It's only a matter of time. Do as you will, she said. Murtagh nodded and half closed his eyes. In the silence of her mind, she began to recite the scrap of verse she used whenever she wanted to hide her thoughts or defend her consciousness from an intruder. She concentrated on it with all her might, determined to repel Murtagh if need be, and also determined not to think about any of the secrets it was her duty to keep hidden.
In El Harim there lived a man with yellow eyes. To me he said, beware the whispers, for they whisper lies. Do not wrestle with the demons of the dark, else upon your mind they'll place a mark. Do not listen to the shadows of the deep, else they haunt you even when you sleep.
When Murtagh's consciousness pressed against hers, she stiffened and began to recite the lines of the verse even faster.
To her surprise, his mind felt familiar. The similarities between his consciousness and, no, she could not say whose. But the similarities were striking, as were the equally prominent differences. Foremost among the differences was his anger, which lay at the centre of his being like a cold black heart, clenched and unmoving, with veins of hatred snaking out to entangle the rest of his mind. But his concern for her outshone his anger. Seeing it convinced her that his solicitude was genuine, for to dissemble with one's inner self was incredibly difficult, and she did not believe that Murtagh could have deceived her so convincingly. True to his word, he made no attempt to force himself deeper into her mind, and after a few seconds he withdrew, and she again found herself alone with her thoughts. Murtagh's eyes opened fully, and he said, there now. Will you be able to recognize me if I reach out to you again? She nodded. Good. Galbatorix can do many things, but even he cannot imitate the feeling of another person's mind. I'll try to warn you before he starts to alter your senses, and I'll contact you when he stops.
That way he won't be able to confuse you as to what is real and what is not.
Thank you,
she said, unable to express the full extent of her gratitude in so short a phrase.
Fortunately, we have some time.
The Vardan are only 3 days hence, and the elves are fast approaching from the north. Galbatorix has gone to oversee the final placement of Urubane's defences and to discuss strategy with Lord Barst, who has command of the army now that it's garrisoned here in the city. She frowned. That boded ill. She had heard of Lord Barst. He had a fearsome reputation among the nobles of Galbatorix's court. He was said to be both keen-minded and bloody-handed, and those who were foolish enough to oppose him, he crushed without mercy.
Not you? She asked.
Galbatorix has other plans for me, although he's yet to share them.
How long will he be busy with his preparations?
The rest of today and all of tomorrow.
Do you think you can free me before he returns?
I don't know. Probably not. A pause fell between them. Then he said,
Now, I have a question for you. Why did you kill those men? You knew you wouldn't make it out of the citadel. Was it just to spite Galbatorix, as he said?
She sighed and pushed herself off Murtagh's chest, so she was sitting upright. With some reluctance, he released his hold around her shoulders. She sniffed, then looked him square in the eyes.
I couldn't just lie there and let him do whatever he wanted to me. I had to fight back. I had to show him that he hadn't broken me, and I wanted to hurt him however I could.
So it was spite.
In part. What of it?
She expected him to express disgust or condemnation at her actions. But instead, he gave her an appraising look, and his lips curved in a small, knowing smile. Then I say, well done, he replied. After a moment, she returned his smile.
Besides, she said, there was always a chance I might escape.
He snorted, and dragons might start eating grass.
Even so, I had to try.
I understand. If I could have, I would have done the same when the twins first brought me here.
And now?
I still can't. And even if I could, what purpose would it serve? To that, she had no answer. Silence followed, and then she said,
Murtagh, if it's not possible to free me from here, then I want your promise that you'll help me escape by other means. I wouldn't ask. I wouldn't place this burden upon you. But your assistance would make the task easier, and I may not have the opportunity to do it myself.
His lips grew thin and hard as she spoke, but he did not interrupt.
Whatever happens, I won't allow myself to become a plaything for Galbatorix to order about as he will. I'll do anything, anything at all, to avoid that fate. Can you understand that?
His chin dipped in a short nod.
Then do I have your word?
He looked down and clenched his fists, his breathing ragged.
You do.
Murtagh was taciturn, but eventually she succeeded in drawing him out again, and they passed the time talking about matters of little import. Murtagh told her of the alterations he had made to the saddle Galbatorix had given him for Thorn, changes that Murtagh was justifiably proud of, as they allowed him to mount and dismount faster, as well as to draw his sword with less inconvenience. She told him about the market streets in Aberon, the capital of Surda, and how as a child she had often run away from her nurse to explore them. Her favourite of the merchants had been a man of the wandering tribes. His name was Hadamanara Nodachu Tagana, but he had insisted that she call him by his familiar name, which was Tagana. He sold knives and daggers, and he always seemed to delight in showing her his wares, even though she never bought any. As she and Murtagh continued to talk, their conversation grew easier and more relaxed. Despite their unpleasant circumstances, she found that she enjoyed speaking with him. He was smart and well-educated, and he had a mordant wit that she appreciated, especially given her current predicament. Murtag seemed to enjoy their conversation as much as she did. Still, the time came when they both recognized that it would be foolish to keep talking for fear of being caught. So she returned to the slab, where she lay down and allowed him to strap her to the unforgiving block of stone once again. As he was about to leave, she said, "Murtag?" He paused and turned to regard her. She hesitated for a moment, then mustered her courage and said, "Why?" She thought he understood her meaning. Why her? Why save her? And now, why try to rescue her? She had guessed at the answer, but she wanted to hear him say it. He stared at her for the longest while, and then in a low, hard voice, he said,
"You know why."
Amid the ruins. The thick, grey clouds parted, and from his place on Saphira's back, Aragorn beheld the interior of Vroengard Island. Before them was a huge, bowl-shaped valley, encircled by the steep mountains they had seen poking through the tops of the clouds. A dense forest of spruce, pine, and fir trees blanketed the sides of the mountains, as well as the foothills below, like an army of prickly soldiers marching down from the peaks. The trees were tall and mournful, and even from a distance, Aragorn could see the beards of moss and lichen that hung from their heavy branches. Scraps of white mist clung to the sides of the mountains, and in several places throughout the valley, diffuse curtains of rain drifted from the ceiling of clouds. High above the valley floor, Aragorn could see a number of stone structures among the trees, tumbled, overgrown entrances to caves, the husks of burnt-out towers, grand halls with collapsed roofs, and a few smaller buildings that looked as if they might still be habitable. A dozen or more rivers flowed out of the mountains and wandered across the verdant ground until they poured into a large, still lake near the center of the valley. Around the lake lay the remnants of the Riders' city, Doru Areba. The buildings were immense, great, empty halls of such enormous proportions that many could have encompassed the whole of Carvajal. Every door was like the mouth to a vast, unexplored cavern. Every window was as tall and wide as a castle gate, and every wall was a sheer cliff. Thick mats of ivy strangled the blocks of stone, and where there was no ivy, there was moss, which meant that the buildings blended into the landscape and looked as if they had grown out of the earth itself. What little of the stone was bare tended to be a pale ochre, although patches of red, brown, and dusky blue were also visible. As with all elf-made structures, the buildings were graceful and flowing, and more attenuated than those of dwarves or humans. But they also possessed a solidity and authority that the treehouses of Ellesmere lacked. In some of them, Aragorn descried similarities to houses in Palancar Valley, and he remembered that the earliest human riders had come from that very part of Alagasia. The result was a unique style of architecture, neither entirely elvish nor entirely human. Almost all the buildings were damaged, some more severely than others. The damage seemed to radiate outward from a single point near the southern edge of the city, where a wide crater sank more than 30 feet into the ground. A copse of birch trees had taken root in the depression, and their silvery leaves shook in the gusts of the directionless breeze. The open areas within the city were overgrown with weeds and brush, while a fringe of grass surrounded each of the flagstones that formed the streets. Where the buildings had sheltered the riders' gardens from the blast that had ravaged the city, dull-coloured flowers still grew in artful designs, their shapes no doubt governed by the dictates of some long-forgotten spell. Altogether, The circular valley presented a dismal picture.
"Behold, the ruins of our pride and glory," said Glada.
Then,
"Aragorn, you must cast another spell. The wording of it goes thus."
And he uttered several lines in the ancient language. It was an odd spell. The phrasing was obscure and convoluted, and Aragorn was unable to determine what it was supposed to accomplish. When he asked Glada, the old dragon said,
"There is an invisible poison here, in the air you breathe, in the ground you walk upon, and in the food you may eat, and the water you may drink. The spell will protect us against it."
"What poison?"
asked Saphira, her thoughts as slow as the beats of her wings. Aragorn saw from Glada an image of the crater by the city, and the dragon said,
"During the battle with the Forsworn, one of our own, an elf by the name of Thuviel, killed himself with magic. Whether by design or by accident has never been clear, but the result is what you see and what you cannot see. For the resulting explosion rendered the area unfit to live in. Those who remained here soon developed lesions upon their skin and lost their hair, and many died thereafter."
Concerned, Aragorn cast the spell, which required little energy, before he said, "How could any one person, elf or not, cause so much damage? Even if Thuviel's dragon helped him, I can't think how it would be possible. Not unless his dragon was the size of a mountain."
"His dragon did not help him," said Glada. "His dragon was dead. No, Thuviel wrought this destruction by himself."
"But how?"
"The only way he could have. He converted his flesh into energy."
"He made himself into a spirit?"
"No. The energy was without thought or structure, and once unbound, it raced outward until it dispersed."
"I had not realized that a single body contained so much force."
"It is not well known. But even the smallest speck of matter is equal to a great amount of energy. Matter, it seems, is merely frozen energy. Melt it, and you release a flood few can withstand. It was said that the explosion here was heard as far away as Tirm, and that the cloud of smoke that followed rose as high as the Beor Mountains."
"Was it the blast that killed Glaren?" Aragorn asked, referring to the one member of the Forsworn who he knew had died on Vroengard.
"It was. Galbatorix and the rest of the Forsworn had a moment of warning, and so were able to shield themselves. But many of our own were not as fortunate, and thus perished."
A Saphira glided downward from the underside of the low-slung clouds. Glada instructed her where to fly, so she altered her course, turning toward the northwestern part of the valley. Glada named each of the mountains that she flew past, Ilthiarus, Felsved, and Narmanmast, along with Hwildrim and Tirnadrim. He also named many of the holds and fallen towers below, and he gave something of their history to Aragorn and Saphira, although only Aragorn paid heed to the old dragon's narration. Within Glada's consciousness, Aragorn felt an ancient sorrow reawaken. The sorrow was not so much for the destruction of Doru Areba, as for the deaths of the riders, the near extinction of the dragons, and the loss of thousands of years of knowledge and wisdom, the memory of what had been, of the companionship he had once shared with the other members of his order, exacerbated Glada's loneliness. That, along with his sorrow, created a mood of such desolation, Aragorn began to feel saddened as well. He withdrew slightly from Glada, but still the valley seemed gloomy and melancholy, as if the land itself were mourning the fall of the riders. The lower Saphira flew, the larger the buildings appeared. As their true size became evident, Aragorn realized that what he had read in Dómhnaill Aberwyrda was no exaggeration. The grandest of them were so enormous, Saphira would be able to fly within them. Near the edge of the abandoned city, he began to notice piles of giant white bones upon the ground, the skeletons of dragons. The sight filled him with revulsion, and yet he could not bring himself to look elsewhere. What struck him most was their size. A few of the dragons had been smaller than Saphira, but most had been far larger. The biggest he saw was a skeleton with ribs that he guessed were at least 80 feet long and perhaps 15 wide at their thickest. The skull alone, a huge, fierce thing covered with blotches of lichen, like a rough crag of stone, was longer and taller than the main part of Saphira's body. Even Gleider, when he was still clothed in flesh, would have appeared diminutive next to the slain dragon.
"There lies Belgabad, greatest of us all," said Gleider, as he noticed the object of Aragorn's attention.
Aragorn vaguely remembered the name from one of the histories he had read in Ellesmere. The author had written only that Belgabad had been present at the battle, and that he perished in the fighting, as so many had.
"Who was his rider?" he asked.
"He had no rider. He was a wild dragon. For centuries he lived alone in the icy reaches of the north. But when Galbatorix and the Forsworn began to slaughter our kind, he flew to our aid."
"Was he the largest dragon ever?"
"Ever? No. But at the time, yes."
"How did he find enough to eat?"
"At that age, and at that size, dragons spend most of their time in a sleep-like trance, dreaming of whatever happens to capture their fancy, be it the turning of the stars, or the rise and fall of the mountains over the eons, or even something as small as the motion of a butterfly's wings. Already I feel the lure of such repose. But awake I am needed, and awake I shall stay. Did you know Belgabad?"
asked Saphira, forcing the words through her fatigue.
"I met him, but I did not know him. Wild dragons did not, as a rule, consort with those of us who were bonded with riders. They looked down on us for being too tame and too compliant, while we looked down on them for being too driven by their instincts, although sometimes we admired them for the same. Also, you must remember, they had no language of their own, and that created a greater difference between us than you might think. Language alters your mind in ways that are hard to explain. Wild dragons could communicate as effectively as any dwarf or elf, of course, but they did so by sharing memories, images, and sensations, not words. Only the more cunning of them chose to learn this or any other tongue."
Gleider paused, and then he added,
"If I recall correctly, Belgabad was a distant ancestor of Raugmar the Black. And Raugmar, as I'm sure you remember, Saphira, was the great-great-great-grandsire of your mother, Thirveda."
In her exhaustion, Saphira was slow to react. But at last she twisted her neck to again look at the vast skeleton.
"He must have been a good hunter to grow so big." "He was the very best," said Gleider. "Then I am glad to be of his blood."
The number of bones scattered across the ground staggered Aragorn. Until then, he had fully comprehended neither the extent of the battle nor how many dragons there had once been. The sight renewed his hate for Galbatorix, and once again Aragorn swore that he would see the king dead. Saphira sank through a band of mist, the white haze rolling off the tips of her wings like tiny whirlpools set within the sky. Then a field of tangled grass rushed up at her, and she landed with a heavy jolt. Her right foreleg gave way beneath her, and she lurched to the side and fell onto her chest and shoulder, ploughing into the ground with such force that Aragorn would have impaled himself on the next spike in front of him, had it not been for his wards. Once her forward slide ceased, Saphira lay motionless, stunned by the impact. Then she slowly rolled onto her feet, folded her wings, and settled into a low crouch. The straps on the saddle creaked as she moved, the sound unnaturally loud in the hushed atmosphere that pervaded the interior of the island. Aragorn pulled loose the bands around his legs, then jumped all the way to the ground. It was wet and soft, and he dropped to one knee as his boots sank into the damp earth.
"We made it," he said, amazed.
He walked forward to Saphira's head, and when she lowered her neck so that she could look him in the eye, he placed his hands on either side of her long head and pressed his forehead against her snout.
"Thank you," he said.
He heard the snick as her eyelids closed, and then her head began to vibrate as she hummed deep in her chest. After a moment, Aragorn released her and turned to look at their surroundings. The field Saphira had landed in was on the northern outskirts of the city. Pieces of cracked masonry, some as large as Saphira herself, lay scattered throughout the grass. Aragorn was relieved she had avoided striking any. The field sloped upward, away from the city, to the base of the nearest foothill, which was covered with forest. Where field and hill met, a large paved square had been cut flat into the ground, and at the far side of the square sat a massive pile of dressed stone that stretched to the north for over half a mile. Intact, the building would have been one of the largest on the island, and certainly one of the most ornate, for among the square blocks of stone that had formed the walls, Aragorn spotted dozens of fluted pillars, as well as carved panels depicting vines and flowers and a whole host of statues, most of which were missing some combination of body parts, as if they too had participated in the battle.
"There lies the great library," said Gleda. "Or what remains, after Galbatorix plundered it."
Aragorn slowly turned as he inspected the surrounding area. To the south of the library, he saw the faint lines of abandoned footpaths underneath the shaggy pelt of grass. The paths led away from the library to a grove of apple trees that hid the ground from view. But rising behind the trees was a jagged spar of stone well over 200 feet tall, upon which grew several gnarled junipers. A spark of excitement formed within Aragorn's chest. He was sure, but still he asked,
"Is that it? Is that the Rock of Cuthien?"
He could feel Gleda using his eyes to look at the formation, and then the dragon said,
"It seems oddly familiar, but I cannot remember when I might have seen it before."
Aragorn needed no other confirmation.
"Come on," he said.
He waded through the waist-high grass toward the nearest path. There the grass was not quite so thick, and he could feel hard cobblestones under his feet instead of rain-soaked earth. With Saphira close behind, he hurried down the path, and together they walked through the shadowed grove of apple trees. Both of them stepped with care, for the trees seemed alert and watchful, and something about the shape of their branches was ominous, as if the trees were waiting to ensnare them with splintered claws. Without meaning to, Aragorn breathed a sigh of relief when they emerged from the grove. The Rock of Cuthien stood upon the edge of a large clearing, wherein grew a tangled pool of roses, thistles, raspberries, and water hemlock. Behind the stone prominence stood row upon row of drooping fir trees, which extended all the way back to the mountain that loomed high above. The angry chatter of squirrels echoed among the boles of the forest, but of the animals themselves not so much as a whisker was to be seen. Three stone benches, their shapes half hidden beneath layers of roots, vines and creepers, were situated at equal distances around the clearing. Off to the side was a willow tree, whose lattice-work trunk had once served as a bower where the riders might sit and enjoy the view. But in the past 100 years, the trunk had grown too thick for any man, elf or dwarf to slip into the space within. Aragorn stopped at the edge of the clearing and stared at the rock of Cuthien. Beside him, Saphira hoofed and dropped onto her belly, shaking the ground and causing him to bend his knees to keep his balance. He rubbed her on the shoulder, then turned his gaze back to the tower of rock. A sense of nervous anticipation welled up inside him. Opening his mind, Aragorn searched the clearing and the trees beyond for anyone who might be waiting to ambush them. The only living things he sensed were plants, insects, and the moles, mice, and garter snakes that lived among the brush in the clearing. Then he started to compose the spells that he hoped would allow him to detect any magical traps in the area. Before he had put more than a few words together, Glada said,
"Stop! You and Saphira are too tired for this now. Rest first. Tomorrow we can return and see what we may discover.
But
the two of you are in no condition to defend yourselves if we must fight. Whatever we are supposed to find, we'll still be here in the morn."
Aragorn hesitated, then reluctantly abandoned the spell. He knew Glada was right, but he hated to wait any longer when the completion of their quest was so close at hand. "Very well," he said, and climbed back onto Saphira. With a weary huff, she rose to her feet, then slowly turned around and trudged once more through the grove of apple trees. The heavy impact of her steps shook loose withered leaves from the canopy, one of which landed in Aragorn's lap. He picked it up and was about to throw it away when he noticed that the leaf was shaped differently than it ought to be. The teeth along the edge were longer and wider than those of any apple leaf he had seen before, and the veins formed seemingly random patterns instead of the regular network of lines he would have expected. He picked another leaf, this one still green. Like its desiccated cousin, the fresh leaf had larger serrations and a confused map of veins.
"Ever since the battle, things here have not been as they once were," said Glada.
Aragorn frowned and tossed away the leaves. Again he heard the chatter of the squirrels, and again he failed to see any among the trees, nor was he able to feel them with his mind, which concerned him. "If I had scales, this place would make them itch," he said to Saphira. A small puff of smoke rose from her nostrils as she snorted with amusement. From the grove she walked south until she came to one of the many streams that flowed out of the mountains, a thin white brook that burbled softly as it tumbled over its bed of rocks. There Saphira turned and followed the water upstream to a sheltered meadow near the forefront of the evergreen forest.
"Here,"
said Saphira, and she sank to the ground. It looked a good place to make camp, and Saphira was in no condition to keep searching. So Aragorn agreed and dismounted. He paused for a moment to appreciate the view over the valley. Then he removed the saddle and the saddlebags from Saphira, whereupon she shook her head, rolled her shoulders, and then twisted her neck to nibble at a spot on the side of her chest where the straps had been chafing. Without further ado, she curled up in the grass, tucked her head under her wing, and wrapped her tail around herself.
"Do not wake me unless something is trying to eat us," she said.
Aragorn smiled and patted her on the tail, then turned to look at the valley again. He stood there for a long while, barely thinking, content to observe and exist, without making any effort to coax meaning from the world around him. At last he fetched his bedroll, which he laid out beside Saphira. "Will you keep watch for us?"
he asked later.
I shall keep watch. Rest, and do not worry.
Aragorn nodded, even though Gleda could not see him, and then he lowered himself onto the blankets and allowed himself to drift off into the embrace of his waking dreams.